I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Man, but laughter was definitely in short supply for Oswald recently. In April of 2016, his wife of 11 years suddenly passed away, leaving him and their 7-year-old daughter deeply grieving. From the start, he was open about his loss and the pain he was enduring. And now, he's actually managed to extract humor from it all. I talked to him about those dark days, his new love, and the state of comedy today.
It's so good to be here with you.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
Thanks for talking to us. No,
thanks for inviting me.
You are a busy guy.
Yes. Dear God. Did they mask out the bags under my eyes for this interview?
Because I don't see bags.
Okay, thank you. Good.
You have a special coming up.
Yes.
You're doing stand-up like crazy. You've got a movie that you're working on.
Yes.
You've got multiple television series.
Yeah, I've got the TV series. Then I have like 4 other regular voiceover gigs. And then I'm writing something for TV, and then I'm still doing a lot of stand-up, because now that the special's coming out, I can't do that material again because people have already seen it, so I've got to generate another hour. So yeah, that's about to start up again.
Do you like being this busy?
Yeah, I actually do. You know, I came out here. I got into this business to work. I like doing creative stuff. I mean, I don't want to. It's not that I just want to punch a clock mindlessly. I want to, right now, I'm just very lucky to be offered projects with people that I'm really excited to work with, and it's hard to, you know, those might not come again. So, I want to say yes. If only to not just do the work, but to get to watch people that I'm a fan of working. You know, to be in a movie by a director who I like, so I want to watch that person work.
Of all the things you're doing, is there something that really feeds you the most or that you love the most?
I mean, it's, you know, stand-up is always going to be the first, because that kind of brought me to the dance. And that is, stand-up is sort of like the last dictatorial post in show business where it's purely you. There's no notes. There's no, you know, no one steers you. It's just all you. But now that I've really gotten back into writing is the hardest thing to do, but when you do it well, it is absolutely the most satisfying. It is such a high when words and sentences or even characters on the page fall together and start doing their own thing out of your control. It's the best.
That solo aspect to comedy, the fact that it is just you and them,
yeah,
that you talked about, you mentioned the positives of it, but it's also why you take it so personally when you bomb, right?
Oh, boy, yeah. I mean, well, when you bomb, especially if you believe that, well, there's no such thing as, well, that just wasn't my crowd. No, you got to make every crowd your crowd. You got to connect with them. So if you bomb, or if worse yet, now what's even worse than bombing for me is having an okay set that I have just done on autopilot, mm-hmm, and I wasn't present, and I come off stage going, well, that wasn't fun for me, and I kind of don't think that was fun for them. In a weird way, bombing, as awful as it is, at least that's a experience where both people are also present. The audience is, wow, this is going badly,
right,
and you're on stage going, oh, dear God. So I'm at this stage now in my career where I'll take bombing over autopilot. I either want to kill or I want to really bomb and then talk about it while I'm bombing. But there have been those nights where you just do the autopilot set and you're like, oh, I just wasted everyone's time. And I don't ever want to do that.
With everything that you have done, mm-hmm, what do people recognize you for most?
You know what? It's still King of Queens. King of Queens really had an interesting second life in syndication, because I remember the writers on that show wanted each episode to just be its own self-contained little film about life and people. So you can just, there's no such thing as when it's on, you're like, oh, I don't really know this show. Well, you can just watch this little 22-minute film, and people really do. And so I'm constantly getting recognized from that, which is great, because that was a really, really fun show to do.
It looked like you guys were having a really good time. Like, it was a bunch of people who genuinely liked each other just doing a show.
The writers were all maniacs and hilarious. Kevin had this great thing where he had a couple of friends who would feed him different lines for every scene so that each take would be slightly different, because he loved that audience reaction. And then watching almost all my scenes were with Jerry Stiller, which was such a gift, because Jerry Stiller had this ability. Sometimes it was almost to the detriment of the show. He could get a laugh with any line. Like, if he came in and just said, you know, like, good morning, Douglas, that would get a huge laugh, which in that line didn't need to get a laugh. They needed to get to whatever the punchline was. But his delivery was so odd and original. It always cracked me up. And watching him work out how he was going to say each line and then throw that away and let himself be surprised by it, that kind of confidence, that's something that I've always been shooting for as an actor.
What did you learn from him? I mean, there's a career that spanned a long, long time. He kept doing comedy the
yes.
whole time. Had a good family, was a good father, you know, a good husband. What did you learn from Jerry Stiller?
What the main thing that I learned was be in... Always remember how lucky you are to get to do this. You don't have to act. You get to act. This is a... So, and even when you're doing something that maybe isn't the best... project or maybe isn't the most, but you're showing up and you're acting. That alone is such a much more fun and vital life than most people are ever afforded. So be gracious and grateful and thankful for it. And he really had, you know, he really was that way. And that was infectious to people around. That's why everyone wanted to keep working with him because he was so fun to work with.
Grew up in Virginia, a self-described military brat.
Yep.
What drove you to do stand-up for the first time?
It's weird. I didn't have the drive to do stand-up. I had this panic of I had better figure out what to do with my life. It was that, you know, the summer between freshman and sophomore year of college where you're going, I have not decided what to do, and maybe I'm... So that was the summer that I tried all these different jobs. I was a DJ. I was trained as a paralegal. I was writing a sports column for a local paper, and then I said, "Oh, I'll just go do an open mic." Because I was always hanging out with friends of mine that were funny, and we all loved comedy. So I said, "Oh, maybe I could write jokes and do." And I did my first open mic, and it was horrible. It was so bad, but I instantly understood what the life of a comedian was, and that's the life I wanted. So I just, everything else got pushed aside, and I just focused on that.
And did things happen pretty quickly for you?
No. I nothing really happened for about the first 2 years. I just sort of did open mics, made no money, banged my head against the wall. I remember the first year that I became a professional comedian, actually did it professionally, I made $7,000 as a comedian. But then the next year, I managed to make $11,000, and at that point, even though I was living on total poverty wages with five roommates and just eating, you know, I would buy a giant bag of rice and a bunch of cans of beans from Food for Less, and I would live on that for a month. I'm like, I'm just making a living doing comedy, so I've made it. So like $11,000 a year to me was, I've made it. I'm so happy right now. So everything else above that's just been gravy.
So all you're looking for
and
is 11,000.
And if it all crashes, I know how to live on $11,000 a year. I worked it out.
Yeah. I mean, beans have not gone up that much since then.
You know, they really, you know what? And thank you, bean producers, for keeping the bean market stable. I can always go back to that. Good. It's a good carb and a solid protein. Thank you.
In that time, since you did become professional and then got on the national scene, how has comedy changed?
I think the one way that comedy has changed for the better and for the worse, for every positive, there's always a weird negative reaction, is that way, way younger comedians can get exposure way easier if they want it because of the internet and the interconnectivity of Twitter and everything like that. That's a very big positive. People that normally wouldn't have the resources to get into certain doors now have those resources. The negative to that is I think a lot of younger comedians are being robbed of their time in the wilderness to figure out who they are. A lot of people get pushed out while they're still in the phase of trying out different personas or different deliveries.
Mm-hmm.
The first 4 years, really, because even though I was doing it professionally, nobody was watching me. I didn't get on TV till I'd been doing it for 4 years. And I'm really glad that no one saw me during those 4 years because I got a chance to figure out who I was. And that was really, really important, that there was no camera on me. There was nothing being broadcast. So, but now it feels like there's a wave coming up after the millennials. There's a comedic wave coming up that now understands the wilderness aspect. They seem to understand it intuitively, and there are people that are keeping themselves deliberately underexposed until they figure out who they are, and then they make their move, which is, that's really cool. It's interesting, you know, that there's just, comedy has changed the way that society has changed. People are just way more showbiz and media savvy because it's just the world we live in now. And so, you know, that old myth about, well, the flyover states, they don't care about Hollywood. Well, they don't care about Hollywood, but they know about it. They know how it works. They understand all the terms now because this is our country after aircraft and agriculture, we export entertainment. I mean, we're basically an entertainment nation. That's one of our biggest exports.
But you're right. You need that time and the seasoning to be bad before
yes.
you, without a lot of eyes on you, before you can be really good.
Yeah, and I think that unfortunately, with this newest generation, which again, I've never seen a higher percentage of good comedians to bad comedians than in the current millennial generation. However, a lot of them got exposure way too quickly because it was just there. And also, I can't blame them. I started when I was 19. If someone had offered me exposure, I totally would have taken it because I wouldn't have known any better. I was hungry.
Right.
You know?
But it's more important to strive to be funny than to strive to be famous, right?
Get good. If you focus on getting good, then the fame will chase you down. You won't have to chase it.
What about the state of clubs? I mean, I talk to a lot of comics who are trying to break in, mm-hmm. and they're having to do bringers and open mics. It's costing them money to actually try and get into the business.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what it must be like being an open micer these days in some of the clubs, and the idea of bringer shows or being on the bark, as they say, where you got to hand out flyers and stuff. You know, I was very fortunate. I never had to do that. Unfortunately, because I was at a time when the clubs were okay with five people being the audience, so I don't know if that's positive or negative. So I have a lot of sympathy for. I don't know what to say. You know, if anything, maybe the one positive will be that because it is such a hindrance to have to be out on the bark and have to do bringer shows, that maybe somebody or a bunch of different comedians will find creative, funny ways to do that will also help form their personalities, maybe. But as far as a touring comedian in the clubs, the club scene right now, if you're a headliner, is fantastic because the crowds are such, they're way more savvy about comedy and they're connoisseurs. Whereas in the 80s, in the late 80s at least, because I started as the boom was collapsing. I basically jumped onto a dying industry when I started. A friend had a joke where you could just put an empty pizza box out front and just write the word comedy on it. People go, fine, we'll go see it. But now, no, there are fans. They can find out who you are, and they want to come and see you. Even people that don't have national exposure yet, that haven't quite broken through, people like Shane Torres, they still have followers that will come and see them. And also now, you know, if somebody saw, like, let's say back in the day, if Louis C.K. was featuring, people would walk away going, wow, that the second guy was really funny. The redhead guy mm-hmm. was good. But now you can remember who that guy is. You can look them up online. You can instantly become a fan of them. So that is really, really helpful.
What about podcasts? How important has that been for comedy right now?
I think podcasts have been fantastic for comedy because it is a way, to do a podcast well, it does take work and time and thought. So a young comedian putting one together, it's not just, I just want to get my face out there. And a lot of them do. There's a lot of terrible podcasts. But there's a lot of amazing ones where you see very early on a young comedian, person, he or she is really, really focused on creating something with depth and personality, and they're willing to put work and craft into what they do. So it's a fantastic showcase. And it's also a great showcase for people that might not completely fit into a comedy club, people that want to do more character type stuff or more theater of the mind stuff. And there's just been some really, the level of writing alone on some of these podcasts, on Welcome to Night Vale, Super Ego, and even non-comedy podcasts like You Must Remember This. It's either great comedy writing or great journalism, or it's so I think it's been really, really important.
all of these different avenues for comedy work better for some people than for others.
Yeah.
Twitter has been tremendous for you. You are actually one of my personal favorite tweeters, and a lot of people's. You managed to make big thoughts into 140 character statements.
Yeah, making big thoughts into 140 characters. I don't know if that's a totally good thing or a totally bad thing, because now everyone wants it. I still try to take the time when I can to sit down and read a much, you know, longer piece, you know, by Ferdinand Mount, you know, say in the New York Review of Books, or a bigger piece in The Baffler, to get a much wider view, rather than, and again, I have people, really astute political tweeters out there, you know, I'm going to name some names of people can follow, like Kushbaum and Patty Moe and Mobute and Buyer Logic and Will Menaker are all, like, if you want a really good take on whatever's going on in the news that day, they are these amazing, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. But yeah, you know, you said earlier, there's all these different venues. See, that's what's great. There's in back when I was starting, is you went on stage, you got a clean 5 minutes, you went on the Tonight Show, and you got a sitcom, and that was the route. That was it. Mm. And if you didn't fit into those steps, you were floating for a little bit. But now there's so many choices of, yeah, you could be a great, do great TV sets and get, that's fine. That's still there. But also you could do podcasts. Podcasts have led to people getting TV shows, have led to people getting writing jobs. Twitter has led to people. Megan Amram is a great example of it. Right. Started out as a hilarious tweeter. Now she's writing for shows, has an Emmy, you know. So they're great showcases for people. There's a guy that writes for Seth Meyers. I believe he was an insurance guy that was just tweeting stuff to amuse himself. And then, you know, someone said, hey, you should be writing for... Anything where more people can showcase who they are on their own terms and at their own pace is always a good thing. And also I would say there's a third rail, which is the internet shows, people that actually shoot stuff. You know, a lot of shows, Broad City, and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and all these, they started as just people shooting stuff of themselves on YouTube, on the internet, and people saw that and went, oh, good. So they were able to, I'll decide how I shook it. Billy Eichner was a guy on YouTube, just shooting stuff the way he wanted it to, so that he didn't have to go and explain this abstract concept. He was like, well, this is what I'm doing, you know. And there's a lot of people now that are getting, you know, a lot of these YouTube shows, they're getting so many views and they're getting sponsorships that now when a network comes calling, they're like, well, what can you offer me? Because before you make your offer, let me tell you what I already have. Mm. And so they're in a much better position to fight for what they want creatively, which I really love.
It's interesting that you went the more traditional route. I mean, you were toward the end, but that you seem to have that kind of control over your career.
Well, because really early on, my heroes were people like, you know, David Cross, and then even before that, people like Albert Brooks, and, you know, that always fought for autonomy and control, and were very, very choosy about their projects, but also approached everything with a sense of, okay, is this going to be fun? You know, it's not that I will only do good. I'm in this for the money and the anecdote. So if I'm going to do something, I either want it to be something great, you know, like Ratatouille, or a gorgeous disaster like Blade Trinity, where I have amazing stories about being on the set. Those are the two things I want. I would work with Darren Aronofsky as quickly as I would work with Uwe Boll, because they would both be amazing stories and they'd be amazing life experiences, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But does that make you a rarity in this business? The fact that you actually really want to take on projects that inspire you and you enjoy, do you find other people doing that?
It might be. Maybe it's a rarity in a much bigger sense, but within the circle of people that I hang out with and my friends, we've always had that sense of, this should be, you know, you should be fat with stories and anecdotes and experiences at the end of all this. So I've always been around people that's been their aim, and I've been able to follow their example.
You have not shied away from politics in the current environment.
Yeah, well, you can't, how, saying that I haven't shied, I don't think, I Since January 20th of 2017, no one has shied away from politics because you can't. I would happily shy away from politics. On all my specials before this, I would mention something that was irking me about Obama or something that was irking me about Bush. But that was a tiny bit, and then I would go on about life. But now it's like I have, because politics isn't shirking us now. It's just down our throats every single day. You can't ignore it. It's this. Right now, politics is just this fire alarm that's constantly going off. So if you were someone that's going, well, I'm just not going to, people will go, you're insane. There's a fire alarm going off. How do you not, whether you're Republican or Democrat, someone has pulled a fire alarm right now. And if you're going to sit there and go, let's talk about the craziness of shopping, like, oh, God, he's gone crazy. He can't even hear it. So, you know, that kind of, I want so badly to shy away from politics, but I don't think I'm going to be able to anytime soon. Because every day there's some new horror.
Does that kind of environment foster better comedy, or is it the enemy of comedy? Does it make it tougher?
You know what? I don't know. I mean, there's that classic cliche of, well, you know, punk rock was great, better under Reagan. But it's like, actually, punk rock was way better under Carter when there was maybe a little bit more hope and ease. That's when we had the Sex Pistols and, you know, the really good Ramone stuff in the early Clash. Then when Reagan came in, it began to get very strident and desperate and not that fun as it was in the 70s. And then when Clinton came in, oh, we got, like, grunge and the Pixies and all this great stuff. And now, I don't know, I haven't seen any great... The only good music that's been coming out since Trump's gotten in has been all this really loud... kind of pop music. I don't hear any good punk. I don't hear any really great abrasive hip hop. You know, I mean, it's hip hop and punk is still being made, but it's not fun because it's all based on terror and rage.
But doesn't this environment make comedy and what you do, making people laugh, more important?
Well, yeah. I mean, if anything, it's not that. I don't want to. I'm always very hesitant to be like, you know, comedians, we're the guys that really we help save society, you know. No, we don't. But we, I do think we are a pressure valve right now, that there are still, there's hope in people, you know, laughing and you know, joy will get you through way more than anger and cynicism will. And that's a hard thing to say at my age, because I could very easily fall back into cynicism and, you know, rage, but I'm trying to hang on to joy, you know, so we'll see.
You have had to hang on to joy quite a bit in your personal life the last year and a half or so. Your special that's coming up is called Annihilation.
Annihilation.
Is that a reflection of the current world, of what you've been through?
Yeah, I mean, that's the closest way I could pick. That was the closest word that I could think of as to how I have been this last year. Annihilated, complete annihilation. Not like damaged and then repaired. Annihilated, in that the person I was doesn't exist anymore, and now it's been rebuilt. You know, I've gone through such extremes of despair and joy in this past year that I don't know if that's good or bad. Like, if you take a super cold glass and put hot water in it, just shatters. You know, that's how I kind of feel, you know, in terms of the despair and now the joy that I'm going through. So, you know, maybe my next special will be called Delirium, or, you know, I don't know. But it's the special itself is essentially about just dealing with that despair and then finding it. What's weird is you don't find hope at the end of despair. It will find you in a way that you're not playing. Like, you'll be working on, okay, I'm gonna revive hope in this way, and this way, and none of them work, and then it surprises you in a way that you hadn't planned it to, which is what happened to me. So, you know, that's kind of what the overall special is about.
Did it surprise you that you were able to make some of these moments and experiences into comedy?
Yeah, I remember I went up 4 months after Michelle passed away. I went up for the first time at some little show here in L.A., and was just trying to talk about it. And I didn't even have jokes written down. I'm like, I'm just going to go on stage and talk about it. Just let it be uncomfortable. So that just that I've gone through the process of being on stage, I just want to get that out of the way. But even in talking about it and talking about how uncomfortable I was, there were a couple of moments of, oh, okay, that is sort of funny if I look at it from that angle, from that, you know. Again, I think anything can be funny, even despair, depending on how you approach it and depending on the context that you put it in. So, and that kind of got me started back on the road to being able to do the special.
Well, and to give background, you have been very open about losing your wife, Michelle McNamara, a wonderful crime writer herself. Last April, she died suddenly, leaving you and your daughter Alice behind. Mm-hmm. You really went into a dark place right after that, and you've talked about it very openly. You mentioned to the New York Times that you don't think you'll ever fully recover from this or be the same person.
Yeah, it's weird. I remember I talked, there was another father at the school that my daughter goes to that said, and he read that article, and he said, you are where I was, because he went, you know, he lost his wife. He had two daughters, and he said, you will go through stages of, I cannot live, and then, okay, I can function, but it won't ever feel like life. Okay, I can live, but I'm never going to experience joy again, and then you'll experience joy again. You'll be 100%. So when they were doing the interview, I was in that stage of like, well, no, I'm living, I'm doing comedy, I'm taking care of my daughter, I'm, you know, trying to take care of myself, but, you know, I'm okay just being totally not whole. You know, because that's where he was. And he's like, I'm telling you, you're on your way. You just don't know where it will be. And now, just like he called it, I'm 100% whole again. You know, if anything, I'm even better, I think, because of being annihilated the way that I was, of being stripped bare of everything that I valued. I learned what, it was like, I said this on Conan, or I think I said it on Stephen Colbert. It's like, well, as awful as, because I had true love with Michelle, but losing that, the one thing that you're able to take from it is you recognize true love when you see it again, and you can avoid it when you don't have it. So that's one thing that I had, and it was prophetic, because then I was able to recognize it when I found it again.
What is the biggest thing that has enabled you to rebuild yourself and to heal? Is it time? Is it the work you put in?
It was time. It was work. For me, it was, you know, getting back up on stage. I'm sure that for someone who is is like a bricklayer that enjoys like making a solid wall, it's got to be that day, the first day you go back and just put a brick up on the cement and see that, okay, you know, I can line these up again. People need buildings. I'm useful. I'm needed here. You know, for a doctor, it's going to see someone. For a chef, I'm sure it's, you know, for a teacher, it's going, I'm going back in the classroom. I'm going to try to break through to the, so that stuff always, you know, it was the time, it was the work. It was definitely, you know, my daughter, seeing how resilient she was and how quickly, you know, she bounced back, and trying to get back in touch with a more childlike aspect of myself to kind of help bring that into the healing.
It also seems like you're really trying to keep the memory of her mother alive for her. She was 7 years old when you lost Michelle.
7 years old, yeah. We would do a thing where at night we would sit down with a book together, a notebook, and we'd write down three things we remembered about Michelle, no matter how trivial they were. But now we have this book just filled with all of these lines of just different, so that she's very, very much alive. And then, you know, her book will come out in February, and her book is so much a part of, it's so personal, it's so much her voice, that when Alice is older, she'll, you know, always have that book to read and go, oh, my mom's right here, you know, there's her voice, there she is, she was alive, and she left this thing. And I've also, you know, a lot of her friends from college sent me poetry that she wrote, stories that she published. I'm going to have all those bound. I'll give those to Alice. You know, there's stuff that I'm saving up as Alice gets older. You know, if she experiences the loss in a different way as she gets older, I have things ready to give to her, going, okay, and because she will process this differently when she's a teenager, when she's a young adult. You know, this will keep hitting her in different ways as she understands new aspects of it, and I always want to be ready there, and ready for her, both with things that she can read and then stuff I can talk with her about. You know, reading a lot of books about it, because grief is not, especially with a child. It's not a, okay, well, now she's over. It's like, well, no, this 7-year-old is over it. The 8-year-old's going to experience new things. The 12-year-old will. The 20-year-old will. So be ready for all that.
Loss doesn't end.
No. Loss has a way of adapting and mutating because, you know, grief, I think, way more than depression really wants to stick around and find a warm place to live. And that's you. So you got to, you know, make it inhospitable. And the way that you make it inhospitable is you keep the joyful parts of the person that you lost alive. And that makes it very, very uncomfortable for grief.
Because it was so surprising and because you were so honest about what happened and about your feelings. I mean, in the last year and a half since this happened, guys like me have asked you a million questions about this.
Yeah.
Is it helpful to you to talk about it? Are you tired of talking about it?
It's not that I talk about it all the time. I wait, you know, for a real, because feelings will sneak up on me that I'm not ready for, you know, so I'll write a long thing either on Facebook or, you know, or I'll publish something in a magazine. And on a selfish level, it's because I'm sending this signal out into the world that I hope will help somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like what when Sheryl Sandberg wrote Plan B, it was so therapeutic for her to see it all written out and then to get feedback from other people going, oh, this helped me, and have you thought of doing this? So that really was amazing for me.
You can see it in your social media that you really established more so than before mm-hmm. Michelle's death, a conversation with your
yeah.
fans, a back and forth
yeah.
About all kinds of things. That personal relationship, I think some of the people on the internet felt, also allowed them to wedge their opinions in a negative
yeah,
way.
Yeah, that's true.
When but... you know, you found some joy, you found some love, you got engaged to a woman who everyone of my generation was in love with, had a giant
yeah.
crush on from Journey of Natty Gann, Meredith
exactly.
Salinger.
Yeah.
You guys met. First of all, was it difficult to open your heart to a new relationship for you?
Yeah, it was. But luckily what happened was we met because we had both been invited to the same dinner party. We have mutual friends. We had never met. We'd never spoken. And then at the last minute, I wasn't able to go for some reason. It was either like a flight. Something got messed up, and I'm like, and I wrote to our friends, I can't make it, I'm sorry. So then the next day, jokingly, Meredith sent me a Facebook message saying, oh, you missed the best lasagna last night. Like, because our friend made lasagna. And then I wrote back, oh, well, you know, we'll go get dessert or something. I was tired, I can't, you know. And then we just started talking back and forth for 3 months. We started in February 28th, and then we didn't see each other face-to-face until May 20th. Mm. Never even spoke. We just wrote, but every night at 9 o'clock, got to the point where it was like, okay, same time tomorrow night, and then I would put Alice to bed, you know, read her story, and then we would just sit there in the dark. It was almost like, it was one of the things that I really, really missed about, you know, being with Michelle, was talking in the dark with someone at the end of the day. And we would just do that for hours every night, for 3 months, like every night. So by the time we met face-to-face, we had opened up about everything. And she was very open and honest about, you know, she knew what I had gone through and was very, you know, so empathetic about that and so intelligent. You know, it's just great to meet another really wise, agile mind that you can engage with back and forth like that. And so by the time we met, even though it wasn't explicit, we were in love, you know, and it didn't take very long to just be like, I just want to be with this person. And then she, you know, moved in, and now we're getting a new house. Like, it seemed, so I think for other people, and another friend of mine that went through, you know, his wife passed away. He got married 9 months later, and he got the same thing from people going, oh, that didn't take long. What the? Bleh? And he goes, look, these people aren't being mean. They don't mean to be mean. But for that, like, you're dealing with this every second of every day. So you're going to move along in your recovery faster than they will, because they're on the outside of it and they think about it a couple times a week. Mm-hmm. But in their mind, they're like, well, I'm not over it. Well, but you're not dealing with it every second of every day, so I'm a little further along. And, you know, It's so, he said, just ignore them. They have other, that's so not their business, you know.
It's not.
Yeah. But keep in mind, this is the internet. On the internet, there are so many. The internet is all about, I'm making it my business. Like, okay, fine, whatever. Ultimately, people on the internet are just electrons. You know, they're probably not going to ever confront you face to face.
Well, when you move yourself along in the healing process enough mm-hmm. to be open to this, you meet this woman, you fall in love, and you announce joyfully, we're engaged. Did you expect the kind of judgment and...
I remember I said this one time to a friend, nothing brings out hatred and outrage on the internet than saying that you love something. if you're on the internet going, this sucks, what a crappy movie that way, people are like, yeah, whatever. But when you're like, oh my God, okay, yesterday I just saw this new movie called The Florida Project with this guy Sean Baker, and I was raving about it on Twitter last night. I was so happy. Like, it's such a good film. And of course, well, I guess you're just being a shill, I see, with it. Like, yeah, I'm getting those huge indie movie bucks from this movie that was made for 10 grand. Yeah, I'm waiting for my Tesla to come in. Like, people get way more outraged when you love something than when you dismiss it or hate it. So, you know, I think people especially on the internet, they're just not comfortable with just clumsy, open joy and love.
Why is that? Why is outrage so easy for people to go to on the internet?
You know, I'm sympathetic to it because a lot of the people that are outraged and angry and cynical, and it's because you're in your 20s. That's all I was in my 20s. When I was in my 20s, everything was like, ugh. If someone loved something, I'm like, yeah, we'll see. I don't know. Like, if someone would rave about a movie, even if I saw it and thought it was great, I would have to keep my stance of like, yeah, I mean, it wasn't perfect, but because when you're in your 20s and you still haven't formed yourself, it's way safer to dismiss and hate things than to take the risk of loving something that other people might not think is great. But when you get older, you're like, oh, wait a minute, I don't care what anyone thinks. I love this thing. It's great. Yeah, but I don't care. And also, I don't care if people love things that I think are silly. I'm just like, all right, fine, you know. If people like a band I don't like, I don't do a 10-minute lecture on, well, actually, no, fine. You like that band? Great. Go listen to it. I don't care. I don't have time.
Was there a sense of wanting to protect Alice from the negative reaction about your engagement? Or did it affect you and Meredith at all negatively?
Meredith and I just kind of laughed it off because we had both kind of joked about, even before we were going to announce the engagement, that, oh, you know, there's going to be people going, you know. I think it probably helps that she and I have, you know, she's been in show business since she was 14, since I was 19. So we're used to, you know, the wolf ticket sellers and people. But as far as Alice is concerned, I mean, she's not really on the internet. It didn't really affect her. We're with her every day, and she's happy. She's happy running around with us and just playing and stuff. So it's not going to affect her.
Keep it that way. Keep her off the internet,
no,
right? Let's keep our daughters off the internet.
I remember I was friends with this celebrity couple, and they had the national, either the Us magazine or that, someone had put together a cover story about how they were divorcing, and it was like using these pictures, and I knew they weren't. I was just like, what? And one of the pictures was at it's her like on the curb looking miserable, like they've been having this fight, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm in that picture. We had gone to this birthday party where you had to take a shuttle to the top of this thing, and it was a million degrees out, and we're both, all the parents are just sitting there just, dear God, just please. And I guess some telephoto guy got her and then just cropped her and then put her with this other picture of her husband hugging this other woman, who the wife was cropped out of that photo because it was a woman they had hired as a songwriter for his album, and she was like, oh, I'm so glad we got this. And they're just leaving the studio going, hey, thanks. So they just made these two photos like, oh, the marriage is collapsing. Like, they literally cropped it. It was just so they can, you know, I'm very used to people doing stuff like that.
So nothing surprises you anymore?
No. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because I don't live my life through, I don't try to answer to the tabloids or to, you know, little gossip sites because they're not real. They don't matter.
With everything you've done and everything you're doing, is there something you really want to do in your career that you haven't done?
I haven't directed a film. I want to make a film. And I just was listening to radio. My friend Aisha Tyler just made a movie. And she did it in a week. She had what? Aisha Tyler is one of the busiest actresses on the planet. She had 1 week off last year, and she made a movie. She goes, I'll just use this week. I'll make a movie. So I'm like, okay, now I don't have an excuse. Now I got to make a movie. So thanks, Aisha.
Do you have plans to direct something?
Yeah. I don't want to jinx it.
All right. We won't talk about it yet.
But I have plans.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Can we talk again then?
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.